Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. Our host this week is Mildred Lynn McDonald. Mildred Lynn will take you on a fascinating tour of the mind-body-spirit connection through a combination of healing conversations, hands-on personal growth tools, and a generous sprinkling of East Coast humor and warmth. Join her as she chats with performance artist, author, and publisher Suzanne Bonet Santo about how to access your own creative stream through combining spoken word, classical and improvised soundscape, and movement. And she'll chat with Kathy Murphy. Kathy's intercultural work in conflict management mediation has provided her with a unique perspective on life, while her background as a mental health nurse educator has gifted her with stellar leadership qualities. Join Mildred Lynn as she dives into the delectable topic of the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 as part of the popular What's Your Prescription for Balance segment. Here's a hint. Apples are considered dirty, while pineapples are considered clean. And she'll moderate this week's Firefly Willows Roundtable with Heisey Lutmers and Firefly Willows founders, John and Deb Caracella. We're excited. Give us a listen. Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together and share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics that are of particular interest to each of them. Listen in as each host takes a turn as moderator. Mildred Lynn McDonald on Healing Conversations the first Sunday, Heisey Lutmers on LIVE with Heisey the second Sunday, and John Caracella on Convergence the third Sunday of each month. Today's roundtable topic is Using Your Voice, How to Bridge the Gap Between Mainstream and Energy Work.
Hello, everybody. This is the Firefly Willows Roundtable, and I'd like to welcome John Caracella.
Hello.
Deb Caracella.
Good morning.
And Heisey Lutmers.
Hi-ho.
We're all here in Studio C in beautiful Los Altos, California.
Love it here.
Enjoying the sunshine.
Very much.
Today our topic is using your voice, using your identity, and walking the line between who you might have been in mainstream before you became, quote-unquote, an energy worker. So what I'm finding is I'm talking to a lot of really talented ladies and gentlemen who have decided to invite energy work into their lives. Where things get a little bit tricky is that there's often a period where they feel a little bit uncomfortable about reconciling who they were before and who they are now in terms of how they're showing up for their family or their coworkers, former coworkers, friends, associates. So I'd love to hear what everybody has to say about that and what your own personal experience has been walking that tightrope. Anybody like to jump in there?
Well, I think the first thing that is really important for people to come to terms with within themselves is one of the big lessons of moving in that direction or being called, sometimes is what people say, in that direction, is it's teaching you to surrender to it, because you have to be willing to accept that's who you are, what you have to offer, and the direction you're going to go, and then be willing to just start putting that out into the world instead of being so concerned about what someone else may think or say about you doing that, because we don't want to try to censor ourselves or hold back parts of ourselves in an attempt to keep everyone around us comfortable, because that discomfort may lead to certain relationships, people, places, things falling away, but that's opening up space for the new things to come in that are in much more alignment with who we're becoming.
So if an energy worker was out there and they're in that transition, the intersection point where the old is intersecting with the new, is there any self-speak or self-talk or affirmations that we can give ourselves to help transition when you feel like you're going into that fear place and maybe falling back into an old identity that doesn't quite work for you anymore?
I think probably do a little self-check. Am I being true to who I am? Does this make me happy? Am I comfortable with who I am? Do I feel uncomfortable, or do I know that I'm not being real? I'm not being who I am right now. I'm still trying to fit in. I'm trying to make someone else comfortable. If you are comfortable with who you are, if you're happy doing what you're doing, saying what you're saying right now, then stay with that. Don't worry too much about other people's sensibilities, other people's feelings. Those are the responsibility of the other party. They're not your responsibility, as long as you're being, you know, not obviously rude or, you know.
Coming from a place of integrity.
Right, if you're coming from a place of integrity. If your intention is not to put someone else down or to make them feel uncomfortable, then you just need to be true to who you are and what you're saying at the moment. And the transition, whether you're moving into a traditional career into energy work or simply a transition in your life, they're very similar. We all move from who we were and what we did into a new space. If you were a stay-at-home mom and your children have gotten to the point where they have moved off and they've gone on to college, you have a transition in your life. And what do you do? Do you hang on to, well, I'm just, not just, but am I still mom? Do I still go to mom groups? Do I still, or do you move forward and become the new you?
Do you feel that people might not feel adequate or have the vocabulary to express their new way of being? Because I know with myself, when I transitioned from high tech into energy work, I really didn't have a good handle on the vocabulary. It was more of a feeling. I know I felt this was truth. I felt this touched my heart. I felt inner peace. I felt fulfilled. But taking that step from being in the feeling and being in alignment and being in integrity with that and being able to express that feeling to other people in an articulate way seems like a huge mountain to climb, at least for a transitional period. Any ideas on that anybody wants to share?
When you ask about an affirmation, mm-hmm. one that I would suggest, and this is literally order that I think it kind of progresses in, is your affirmation is own it, do it, say it, be it. Because first you have to own it within yourself. This is who I see myself becoming, or this is what I'm going to be doing, this is where I'm feeling called. Then you just start doing it, because you want to do it, and sometimes you don't have the words to explain or describe what it is, but through doing it, you start to develop a vocabulary for yourself, to not only for yourself as to how you're explaining it to yourself, but then how you can say or explain it to someone else. And then once you're able to say it, you're doing it, you're saying it, and then you be it, you become it, because that's just how you walk in the world rather than it's something you're doing, like something you put on and take off, versus it simply is who you are. So that would be my affirmation, and kind of the order is own it, do it, say it, be it, because sometimes the saying, the vocabulary you're asking for comes after the doing versus needing to know how to describe it or give it words before actually doing it.
I would offer two words to come to mind. One is patience and the other is judgment. So I'll start with patience. When you shift from who you were to who you want to become, you are starting new. Now, if you could take the time, take a moment, and remember what it was like, for example, you're fresh out of college, this is your first job, right? What you knew, what you didn't know, the vocabulary that was at your disposal, who you were, who you chose to rely upon to teach you. You were a newbie back then. When you make a transition like we're talking about here from, say, the corporate world into energy work, or even from being a full-time mom to being an independent woman, you got to remember that you're not 50 years old in that role. You're a newbie. You're just fresh out of college or fresh out of high school or fresh out of elementary school in that role. So being patient with yourself, realizing that you have a lot to learn. You can rely on a lot of life lessons, but gee, there's an awful lot you don't know. And look how long it took you to learn the other stuff, right? So being patient with yourself is really, really important. The other thing is judgment. When we judge other people, what's happening is information is being revealed about the person who's doing the judging, not the person who's being judged. So when you contemplate putting yourself out there and you fear someone drawing a conclusion about you, it's not about you. Whatever conclusion is being drawn about you by that person is a statement about them, that gives you a kind of freedom to allow yourself to be who you are and trust that the people who are judging you harshly are only judging you harshly because they're in a process of their own self-discovery. There is some discomfort in being judged harshly by other people, but it's not about you, it's about them.
Hi, so you had mentioned earlier, before we had the round table, a really interesting concept of transition, about being in the energy of transition. Do you want to share a little bit about that?
So I get a lot of people that come to me for reading sometimes that feel like they want to do some sort of healing work or energy work or whatever. And usually they're asking in the context of, when can I leave what I'm doing and be doing this full time? And I want to do it sooner rather than later. We don't just become this overnight. And we have to allow for that transition. Like an example would be, you know, when you leave a job, you give 2 weeks notice so that there's time to transition out of the old job, both for yourself as well as who you're working for, to make the transition, hand things off to. And then you move into something new. So I think people, we get very excited, and I think we get a little impatient because, oh, now I want to do this. This is, you know, I want to become this. But we have to allow for the time to move into something. And moving into something doesn't always mean full time. That's also, I think, the other mistake a lot of people make. Oh, I'm feeling called to do healing work, so that means I need to be able to do this full time and still make the same amount of money I'm making in my corporate job, and. And sometimes it's just something we're supposed to be offering, not to judge the quality of what we have to offer based on the quantity that we can do it. Being a healer on the weekend is just as valuable and just as needed and just as worthwhile as somebody who does it 7 days a week. That may be all that we're being asked to do or to offer, is what we have the ability to do, which may be on weekends or certain evenings or, you know, offering workshops once in a while or something like that. But we want to make sure that we allow that expression. And that may just be the transition, which is I just transition into this being a part of what I do and offer in the world rather than being the only thing that I do or that defines me.
Do you find when energy workers start out, they put a tremendous amount of pressure on themselves to show up a certain way or to be in integrity or a certain way or to, as you were sharing, have a full-time business or practice thriving day one, or they feel that something's not complete or something's not gelling? Where do you feel that they get that belief system that doesn't serve them?
I imagine that it's a holdover from the way the corporate world, the rest of the world, works. We decide how value is given based on whether we make money at it, whether we see another number of people. So we create these little criteria that, well, if I haven't done this, and this, then I'm not good at it, or I'm not real, or whatever, because that's how we've always been taught. I mean, you get grades in school, and if you don't get your A or your B or your whatever, that means a certain thing. And I think we have the same kind of sense for how else will I know, mm-hmm, if I don't have something, some kind of criteria against which I can make a little check mark and say, well, I met this. Oh, I must be here. I must have done it.
But I think what you do find with a lot of times people moving into healing work, they expect that to happen overnight. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the work world, you don't expect that. When you graduate college, now we could get into a whole conversation about the entitlement society we live in nowadays, but when you graduate college, you don't expect to then become CEO of the company in your first job. You think, okay, I have to, you know, the classic thing is like I have to start in the mailroom and I work my way up.
Mm-hmm. Patience.
But in the healing world, there doesn't seem to be a sense of working your way up to something versus it should all just be right there in front of me tomorrow. And I think it's that misguided way of thinking, well, if the universe wants me to do this, mm-hmm, then it's going to plop into my lap a full-time business for me to move into right now so that I can move out of what I'm doing and into that. Otherwise, the universe wouldn't want me to do this, which, yeah, is a very unrealistic expectation to put on the universe.
And mm-hmm, and frankly, it's a misinterpretation of your gifts. Because
right,
in everything that we do, there's learning that has to occur. And if you're going to step out of one thing into something else, even if you're called there, don't expect that you're not going to have a lot of things to learn. If you were handed a practice that was full, the first day you decided to become an energy worker, you probably wouldn't be able to do a very good job there.
Right.
No, there's a lot to learn. Remember, you are, you know, it's your first day on a new job, in a new career, in a new industry. Unless you are an entrepreneur, okay, what do entrepreneurs do when they decide they're going to start a business? They do a whole bunch of work. They do a bunch of work before they start, and they do a bunch of work every day that is not the fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to move into energy work as an entrepreneur and be your own power center, be prepared to have to do a lot of work and learn a lot of new things.
Be willing to take classes in how to run a business, how to manage finances.
Yeah.
It's not all workshops on angels all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
As what's going to help you sustain a business.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, you know, it is about internal sustainability, right? You have to do the things that sustain you internally, but part of the things that sustain you internally are things like food, things like shelter. So you have to, if you really want to pursue the vision of yourself in energy work, then you have to be willing to do what will sustain you in that process.
Again, it's not always about how do I make the transition to doing the healing work all the time. Part of what you may be learning is how do you still do that work that you're called to do, but in the everyday world environment?
Mm-hmm.
How are you the healer when you are in your cubicle and in a corporate work setting on a daily basis? And what do you bring to the work and to the people around you rather than it needing to somehow be separate from that or in a separate space from that?
Yeah.
I love Deb's point about the checklist. What will be on it for you guys?
Gratitude.
Yeah, gratitude in the sense of inner abundance.
Okay. Anything else?
Feeling as if you're making an impact on others in a way that is helping to improve them or their lives or help them move forward on their path.
Okay. I'd like to throw out...
well, let's get our listeners to throw out some our way, because I think that would be a nice checklist to have.
So feel free to visit our Facebook page, Firefly Willows, and comment on the show if you have other things you think would be good for the checklist to offer people, because we'd love to hear what you also think would be measurable criteria that isn't so physical, tangible, or material that other people in either in or moving towards doing healing work can use.
Well, that's our roundtable for this week. Many thanks to this week's moderator, Mildred Lynn McDonald, and participants, Heisi Lutmers and John and Deb Carosella. Next week, our roundtable moderator will be Heisi Lutmers. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned. Firefly Willows is excited to announce a new workshop, The Magical Roots of Reiki, Bringing Forth What is Hidden. Participants in this workshop will explore the esoteric knowledge hidden within Reiki, delve deep into its history, meaning, and mystical source, and experience firsthand the power that powers Reiki. Join us in Los Altos, California in July 2012 as we host Jose Figueroa Garcia, Director of Natural Therapies of Oslo, Norway. Jose offers this workshop in English and his native Spanish. Visit fireflywillows.com for more details.
Welcome back. This is Mildred Lynn McDonald, and we hope that you're enjoying the show today. In a few minutes, we'll be heading to Toronto, Canada, to visit artist, author, and publisher Suzanne Benet Santo. During our time together, we'll talk about how you can access your own creative stream through combining the spoken word, beautiful sounds, and expressive movement. As a special treat, she'll share a tidbit from her new book and fill us in on her own personal journey of hope, courage, and wisdom. Later in the show, we'll sashay over to Conception Bay, Newfoundland, to talk with the refreshing Kathy Murphy, a gifted and generous conflict management specialist who'll share with us what you've learned about respect, inclusion, diversity, and humor. Then, please join us for this week's What's Your Prescription for Balance, where I'll share with you the secret behind the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen. And now, let's connect with Suzanne Benet Santo and see where the conversation takes us after a visit to her inspiring website. Suzanne, I've been on your website. I find it fascinating. And I'd love to talk to you about your unique creative facilitation process.
Absolutely. The motivation that I have in this work has always been to find a way to be of benefit to others in the best way I'm able, to share what my wonderful teachers have entrusted me with in ways that I'm qualified to do. That's not as a lama, not as a therapist, but as an artist and an educator, bringing forth ways to approach movement, sound, and the spoken word in ways that help people feel well and bring people together in joyful ways.
Now, I understand that one of the sources of inspiration was your son.
Absolutely. When my son was 6 weeks old, he suddenly had a cerebral hemorrhage just out of the blue. It came, as you can imagine, quite a shock, because he'd been a very healthy, alert little baby, a very happy little baby, and then suddenly he was in a coma. It was the most frightening thing that you could ever imagine. I should say that he's now very well and enrolled in a library and information science program, but originally we were told that he would likely be a blind, deaf, spastic hemiplegic. He didn't speak until well after the age of 4, and I had to hand feed him every meal until he was over the age of 5. I homeschooled him, and prior to even beginning any of that, I began a long study of what kind of behavior, mood, environment sets the stage for learning. And then I started to learn about how the brain works. And what kinds of movements make the brain more able to take advantage of the wonderful neuroplasticity that is its inherent gift. Just gradually, I moved into an awareness of how to combine movement and writing and sound. I've always felt that there was a purpose that we come here in life to fulfill, without really having it be necessarily scripted in my own mind what that was, that there was an inner meaning, and that has always given me a sense of support in carving out my life and giving me a confidence that we must just go on regardless of the twists and turns that life takes us through.
So that well of knowing rose to the forefront when you were faced with this huge curveball.
Absolutely.
There's people listening who are facing something similar, and they're probably asking themselves, how is she so strong?
Well, my source of nourishment and inspiration is the relationship I have with my meditation teacher, the Tibetan Lama Sogyal Rinpoche. You may have heard of or read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. This is not the same, by the way, as a book called the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is much more difficult to read. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying came into my life not too long after my son had his third brain surgery. The book came into my life in a very special way, almost as a living being in and of itself. And I felt that there was a loving, healing energy that really came out from the book at a time when I felt very wounded. And it led me to Rinpoche. After I read the book, I had to meet him, and I did. So I was very fortunate to make the personal connection. Even in just reading the book, I'd say it's a wonderful resource for people who are facing all kinds of things, including critical illnesses of themselves or family members. So I would highly recommend that.
And that book would be available on Amazon, perhaps?
It is available on Amazon.com.
Okay, great. And what about anybody else? I think there was someone else you had shared with me that was a source of nourishment and inspiration for you.
Oh, yes. I've been very fortunate to have been able to work with Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who is best known for having written Women Who Run with the Wolves. She is a senior Jungian analyst as well as a keeper of the old stories. And for me, Dr. Estes is a wonderful representative of the wisdom of the feminine, and it's so needed at this time in the world. I respect and really revere Sogyal Rinpoche as a wonderful representative of the masculine. Good balance.
Yeah, that's what it feels like to me. You brought into your life a very healing, nourishing source of masculine energy and a very healing, nourishing source of feminine energy. How wise of you.
I think it's a very good model because there's something in us that looks for parental figures. I think we all want to connect to something like that.
Now, I know when I was looking at your videos and enjoying your videos on your website, you talked about wisdom sources.
I have the understanding that each human being has a source of something holy within themselves, and that is also reflected in certain holy beings with whom we feel a sense of kinship. They're like mirrors of something that's within us that helps to awaken our own truest intelligence, which speaks from the wisdom center located in each of our hearts.
So how about yourself? What would be your personal wisdom source or sources?
Well, I've taken refuge in Sogyal Rinpoche, and he's something like a telephone line through which I contact my wisdom sources. But at the same time, there's a deep stratum of my being that feels connected with Holy Mother. Some call her the Virgin Mary or the Black Virgin or Guadalupe, and sometimes it's called Magna Mater or Gaia. I feel a connection both through the Tibetan Buddhist lineage, as it's represented by Sogyal Rinpoche, but also the deep, deep feminine.
Suzanne, I'm really curious about the type of people who are attracted to your work.
The people who come to me typically are in middle years or beyond. They may have seen members of their family die. They themselves may have suffered and weathered many storms. They don't come to me for therapy. They come to help rejuvenate the way their physical bodies move and express their heart's messages. I can help them find ways to discover words to pass on the wisdom that they may have distilled over many, many years.
How do they usually react? What do they say when they find you?
You find the process very joyful, but sometimes there are tears. What we find is that parts of the person that have been left behind in various ways over the years, sometimes when we start to rediscover it, it's like moving a leg or a foot that may have gone to sleep, and there can be a tingling and soreness as it comes back into use. Normally and usually what we find is an enormous sense of relief at last having the time to create a space for themselves to connect with their creative life. It may have been overlooked for long stretches as they cared for other people. They're having a chance to come back home to themselves.
That sounds so powerful and rewarding.
It's very rewarding. I just love this work.
I know when I went to your website and I looked at your work and I looked at the videos, I thought to myself, wow, I didn't know a person like this existed. This is fabulous. So do you get that type of authentic, genuine, wow reaction?
Absolutely. People do respond. I make a point of really being there for people, and they're very, very happy to be in a space where they're deeply listened to and really offered a time and container to refine themselves.
I know some of your work is intergenerational.
It's such an important point. I particularly cherish those times when we assemble a group with different ages, because it's so rare in our society to have the opportunity to freely express our whole selves. And especially rare to be able to experience other age groups in action. And prior to the onset of assembly line education, we had systems of apprenticeship in which farms, workshops, or studios included various age groups and different levels of skill and expertise. And in this way, various kinds of learning take place organically, depending on particular strengths and aptitudes of different members of the group. So the stronger ones or the ones with the most nimble fingers stepped forward when that particular need arose. Just like in an orchestra, you have the triangle and the kettle drum and the violins. Each of us have special gifts to offer, including the very young and the very old, and those with special challenges. When we bring people together, we have the opportunity to hear the whole human orchestra play, and it's a beautiful sound.
Young women especially are not able to identify with an older woman and how she ages naturally.
We have forgotten what healthy aging looks like. We are actually very hungry for this. We want to see women's hair going gray. We are happy when we see people with wrinkles. We need to have the view of what it looks like when we pass from the age of so-called being in our prime into being someone who has a harvest of memory and experience, someone we can share with and understand their memories as an elder. Young people need a chance to see the beauty and healthiness of aging, and even the healthiness of dying.
Mm-hmm. The cycle, the natural cycle.
The cycle, this is a natural cycle.
Now I know why I love British actors. They look like normal people.
Right.
Suzanne, you create a space for people to be witnessed in ways that they may never have really been witnessed before. So I'm wondering what type of feelings and emotions and shifts accompany this process of truly being witnessed.
Well, what we find is that in opening the container for creators to bring forth their treasures, our participants feel strengthened and validated, and they feel the life force. They feel validated as artists and also as beings who have the power to offer something real and something holy, which is very accessible. Confidence, which this inspires, transfers to other areas of their life. There is always something in us which seeks love and recognition, just the way that plants turn toward the light of the sun. As we start to come into contact with the light of the wisdom of our own deep knowing, a sense of the sacredness of all life and all activity begins to emerge. This is a huge thing, Mildred Lynn. Everyone has a natural need to be seen and beheld. And this is the kind of space that I like to set up because it's really very natural and normal. And it brings a sense of deep satisfaction.
If someone's not being witnessed, what are they being? So is it almost like a dam where you're repressing, and the water builds and builds and builds, and eventually the dam will explode, and people's natural rhythm or natural need to be witnessed or hugged or honored bursts out?
Sometimes it doesn't burst out. Sometimes it just sort of implodes into depression. That's what we'd like to avoid. Especially older people seem to have the tendency to become sad or dry if they're not seen, and they have so much to give. Being in contact with younger people is stimulating. It's stimulating for the young people to see the older people, and it's wonderful for the older people to be challenged and refreshed by the younger ones.
Now, if someone's listening out there and they're or they're saying to themselves, this is making so much sense to me. How can I facilitate creativity in my life? What would be some tips or hints that you could provide to them?
Well, I think one of the most important habits we can develop is to create a daily practice of meditation, which can be as simple as sitting down in front of a table, in front of a picture of something that holds inspiration to you, and asking for its guidance, protection, and blessing to infuse your being, and to do that each day. Because if we make a habit of doing this, just as we have built up a habit of a daily bath or a shower, we will be more prepared to face the challenges of each day with the sense of being prepared to respond in an alert, relaxed way. And that is the essence of creativity. You will be a stronger and more healing force for everyone you come into contact with.
I'm going to switch gears for just a moment and ask you a little bit about Red Butterfly Publications. I love the name. I love the concept.
Well, the seed source for Red Butterfly Publications was the beautiful sensitive writing that began to emerge in the workshops. After our invocation for own wisdom sources, we always enter into a series of physical movements. These repattern the brain and warm up the whole spine and physical essence, and they include some figure eight movements. These are a very natural wave-like action, which naturally brings people into a sense of wellness and coordination. As we were doing these figure eight movements, they began to develop into a pattern which seemed to me to look like the wings of a butterfly. As the group began to fit our written work together, because we follow the movements with some writing, the theme of the butterfly began to emerge in the writing. And this is a theme of letting go of all we've known so that new life may emerge, and to do so with confidence that life is ever renewing, even though we may not know where it will take us, and we may feel that our entire circumstances are melting down. What is the most important is maintaining the sense of trust and faith in the goodness of our inherent being, and constantly renewing the courage to meet life with an aware, an open heart. So my wish is to develop Red Butterfly as a publishing house for clients who wish to work with me in this unique process I have developed, which brings them into the awareness of the inherent goodness of the cycles of life, and bringing together an expression of the unity of matter and spirit in their own creative lives, so that it may serve as a source of renewal, both for themselves and for other people.
So if someone was really resonating with what you're talking about and they wanted to express themselves through the written word, would they be able to contact you at Red Butterfly Publications?
They can contact me through my website.
Okay.
www.SuzanneBenetSanto.com. That's spelled SuzanneBenetSanto.com.
Suzanne, I'd love to talk to you a little bit about your book and also about the beautiful artwork that's associated with the book. Can you share?
Oh, I'd love to. The book is called Returning, A Tale of Vasilisa and Baba Yaga. And the artwork is by a French painter by the name of Odilon Redon. The tale I'm recounting in this book is one which has held a great fascination for me since I first heard it as a very small girl. It's a tale of a little girl who has lost her mother. In this case, after a time, Vasilisa's father remarries, and the new wife is not pleased, not happy to be left with this child who is not her own. The new wife does not want to be saddled with nurturing a project which she herself did not bring forth. She's quite willing to sacrifice her to the great, dark, dangerous being that lives at the center of the ancient forest, keeper of the passage of time, keeper of the horses of day and of night, the mysterious death-dealing Baba Yaga. Now in herself, Vasilisa, the young girl, grieving for her lost mother, the dear, sweet, giving and supportive, loving, nurturing force which held up her life and kept her safe, is gone and is no longer able to help Vasilisa nor to hold her. And Vasilisa is no longer able to smell the security of her mother's clothes or feel her hair, but has to fend for herself in the company of jealousy and hostility, in the company of strangers who have now invaded what used to be Vasilisa's own home. This stepmother did not brush Vasilisa's hair nor mend her clothes and pretended to see nothing of the tangles in her hair and the torn hem coming down. In fact, Vasilisa's needs were a source of annoyance. And an idea, it came to her, the stepmother. She would rid herself of this troublesome nuisance now and forevermore by pretending the cooking fire in their house had gone out and sending Vasilisa to bring some home. The source of the fire, Baba Yaga, lived far away in the deep, dark forest in a strange house which walked by itself on big, tall, scaly chicken legs, was surrounded by the bones of children which the Yaga had eaten, and her house was lit by skulls from which strange fire shone forth. "It is to this place you must go, girl," Vasilisa's stepmother told her coldly, and they both knew it was likely Vasilisa would never return. But Vasilisa had something in her pocket, something which could help her. For in the very last moments before her dear, sweet mother had drawn her last breaths, her mother had given her a doll dressed just like her in black, white, and red. "Take this doll, my dear," her mother had murmured, "and never forget you have it. This doll will guide you if you only remember to ask. She has strength and can help you, but you must always remember to feed her a little bit of bread each day, and each day to give her a little sip of water. In that way, she will always stay alive and be there for you to help you carry on." And as soon as her mother finished telling her that, she died. Vasilisa, left with the enormous task of confronting Baba Yaga, does have this tremendous resource of wisdom love, a gift from her mother and her mother's lineage. For the clothes they wore, she and the doll and her mother, were the clothes of black, white, and red, of the endless cycle of night, daybreak, and sunset. And Vasilisa did remember to always feed the doll and give her a little drink of water each day. And the doll, as you will find out, does know exactly how to help Vasilisa. Vasilisa is you, and she is me. She is every girl and every woman who has had to retrieve the sacred fire. She is every girl and every woman who has felt abandoned and alone, unprepared. But she does have, and we do have, this sacred, private, inner resource. It is our task, feed it, though, each day. We must remember to do so, if it is to guide us, and if it is to help us retrieve the fire of warmth and of light, so that we may ultimately bring it back for ourselves as well as for others. And that is what the book is about.
It really pulls you in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, this beautiful message is also adorned by fabulous artwork. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Odilon Redon is a wonderful artist. He's not very well known here in North America. He's French, and he was born in 1840. He died in 1916, and he lived through a lot of difficulties. He had quite a bit of suffering as a very sensitive soul. But in the end, his life became colorful and joyful.
His life's journey and his artwork really fits into your message and the creative facilitation process.
Absolutely. Just,
who do you envision reading this book?
This is a book for all ages. It is not exactly a fairy tale in the sense that they've become trivialized. But fairy tales in their origin are meant as bearers of deep wisdom. So I see this as something that can be read by a child, but it can also be deeply enjoyed by someone in their mid-50s or someone in their 80s.
Okay. What are you doing over the next couple of months? What do they hold for you?
Well, I'll be here in Toronto for another 2 weeks, and then I will be going into a deep retreat at Lerebling, Sogyal Rinpoche's retreat center in the south of France, until early October.
To me, it sounds like you're doing some heavy-duty nourishing and cleansing.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you'll come back all topped up, and then you'll gently and easily move into October and whatever projects you have on the go in October.
Yes.
And how can people get a hold of you? I know there's people listening and they're saying, I would like to learn more about Suzanne and her work. What would you recommend?
Well, the simplest way is through my website, www.suzannebenetsanto.com. As I said, the link for the book is there, as well as my calendar. If you'd like to schedule Skype sessions with me, you can just click on the link for my email address, which is posted there. And if you'd like to arrange for me to come and visit, we could discuss potentially the logistics for that.
Excellent. And Suzanne, I wish I could spend more time with you, but I'm not able to do that right now. So what I'd like to do is to invite you to come back again.
Yes, I would enjoy that very much, Mildred Lynn. It's been a pleasure to spend this time with you. May this be of benefit to all beings. I truly hope that our conversation does reach out through the web, which transcends space and time, and be a source of healing.
That's beautiful, Suzanne. Thank you so much, and you take good care of yourself today in Toronto. I hope you enjoyed our chat with Suzanne Benet-Santo. I don't know about you, but the sound of her voice makes me feel stronger, more connected, and dare I say, even braver. If you've ever been to Newfoundland, Canada, you'll know that Conception Bay is especially beautiful and welcoming. It's here that we'll find Kathy Murphy, who after working in the Middle East as a conflict management specialist, is more than happy to share some nuggets of wisdom about intercultural respect, inclusion, diversity, and even throw in some humor. Later in the show, please join us for our popular What's Your Prescription for Balance, where I'll share with you the secret of the clean 15 and the dirty dozen. This is your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald. You're listening to Healing Conversations, brought to you the first Sunday of every month by Firefly Willows Live in Los Altos, California. Now, let's jump over to the Atlantic Shore to visit with Kathy Murphy in Conception Bay, Newfoundland. Hi, Kathy. I'd love to welcome you to our program today. And you're calling in from?
I'm calling in from Conception Bay South, Upper Gully, in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Kathy, a lot of people who listen to this show love nature, and I understand that where you're situated in Conception Bay, your home area is very nature-oriented.
I live in the middle of the woods, and I live on a lake. So I'm sitting now at my table, and all the back of my house is windows, so I'm looking out onto water. So there's all kinds of birch trees and spruce and fir trees circling the house, and the house has some of the wood that we cut. When we cut the house, a good friend of mine came to my home and did a blessing in four corners and asked the earth if it would accept this home. People come in and they often say, it's like the house hugs you, and it does. It's a home that hugs you.
I remember looking for land, and when I would walk on a piece of land, which was by the ocean, my first instinct was to smell the land. Yes. I would stand there and close my eyes, and I would just smell it. So what does your land smell like?
The smells are beautiful. That's a wonderful question. And it depends on what time of the year it is. And in the winter, it's such a cold kind of fresh smell that just wakes you up and just makes you really glad to be alive. And then there's times of the year where it's strong smells of all that life coming back into, like, the plants and the trees. Then there's this wonderful calm and beautiful breeze that just really seduces you here. When you get on my back patio, you really feel like this is the realest part of the world and maybe we could just stay here. But then other things interrupt, like life and work.
You are a champion in the area of respect and inclusion and diversity. And a little part of me knows that your Newfoundland heritage has helped you shine in these three areas.
Fundamentally, I think as a child, where I was born and born on an island, and an island being very communal, I understood very early and at a very, like, a soul level that I was interconnected and interdependent on so many people around me. And not that I thought about survival, because you don't think survival, but I had a very strong understanding of the importance of all the people that would come into my life and their role in what was my life. That was part of a culture and learning that was passed on to me, especially when I think about my grandmother. And she was one of seven sisters who lived in what was the first subsidized housing in a city that probably would have seen that as a very negative thing. That time, you know, 50 years ago when I was born, because that's where I lived when I was first born. But within that community, there was such diversity of people. And because that community would attract individuals who at time were lost, individuals who may be struggling, or just individuals who their own journey finds them in this little small community. And my grandmother was able to create space for so many people. she created space for my father and my mother and me with 11 other people in her little house. But she also was able to make space for other people who came to her house that needed that safety. And I was very young understanding that and knowing that about her. That fundamental acceptance of people, that belief was taught to me by her and by my father and my mother. It was like kind of core somewhere, like they seen the world.
Did you feel that you were able to absorb that and nurture it within yourself? And then as you walked out into the world, you were able to take that perspective with you?
Absolutely. My grandmother taught me joy, joy and laughter. She came at the world with joy. And my mother would say to me sometimes, I'd really like to live in the world that you and your grandmother live in. and she'd smile, and you know, and but sometimes I wasn't sure if it was a compliment or if she was making, like, where are you and where, what land do you come from? But it was just this looking for what was the strength in people and truly believing in that, believing that there was a strength in a person, believing in the goodness. And my grandmother would even talk about the light in somebody. Like she said, there's such goodness and light in people and looking for that. And my father, well, he didn't use that language, sent the same messages about the non-judgmental looking for the goodness in people. And my mother being the same, very compassionate and kind, and being able to have healthy boundaries so to keep themselves okay in that. When you think about it, nurturers, and I think about my family all the time, they came from really challenging situations, but were able to find a whole lot of joy in family in the middle of that.
Now, Kathy, you're a person that I spoke to, and you said, I kind of knew at an early age that I had a passion around this area.
It's probably one of my strongest memories as a child. My parents finally left my grandmother's community and moved to the country. And so I think I was probably maybe 6, and I decided that maybe I should go visit and live with my parents as well. So I ended up moving to the country and would live with my grandmother in the summer. I would have to get this bus to go to school. It was like the yellow school bus, and it was a community bus. So at lunchtime, I would come home, and then I would go back to school on the bus. I would travel independently. I was always very able to do things, and I have some wonderful stories about that. Well, but at a very young age, I had a real sense of how I was going to get through this world. And I remember standing at the front of the bus, and I would look at the people on the bus. There was always this very strong, centered feeling of caring. And I truly, and I think I had so much love around me that that's what I felt always. I felt loved, and I felt love towards other people. And I would sit with individuals, and people would tell, all of a sudden start telling me their stories. And I remember once sitting next to this woman, and I asked her how she was. And you imagine, I was 6 years old, and brown eyes, really chatty. And how are you today? And she told me to stop talking. And you know, you think as a child you'd be right hurt. Well, I wasn't hurt at all. I remember thinking, well, today she doesn't want to talk. And I just sat there very silent and still really felt there was even a more important need for me to care about her. And I think that was like a fundamental, it was fundamental what really led me into the work that I would do.
Kathy, another interesting comment that you made to me was in the arena of respect. And what surprised me is you said, well, respect may be viewed differently by women in different cultures.
Absolutely. And I think it's a word that creates very strong positions for people in their own minds when they say, I want to be respected or I want to feel respected. In their own head, they have an idea of what that word means. And what that word means is very connected to their culture and to their upbringing and to their heritage and to their family, to their education. The word is influenced by their journey, where they were born, how they were treated, how they saw other people being treated. their religion would have impacted what that word meant. So when I use the word respect in different settings, it's amazing to me what it means to people. So when I travel to the Middle East, my journey began the moment I got off that plane, because I learned very quickly that my toolkit that I had brought from Canada really needed to stay on that plane with the cargo.
Oh, okay.
Because I was going to need another toolkit if I was going to be truly respectful of the diversity that I was going to be working with. And I remember that I gave myself the first 3 months to just allow me to feel connected, or just to get present in this new environment. And that's not a very long time, because I really needed to allow myself a couple of years to do that. But I only had a year in the country, and I thought to myself, to be true, I need to understand where I'm to. I need to understand more the cultures. And I learned very quickly that I was naive thinking that I understood. I understood our sameness, and I think that's where we go, but I truly never understood our differences. And to be respectful, I really needed to understand that. And I was traveling with this woman. We were ushered to the back seat, because women, you know, sat in the back seat. We didn't sit in the front seat. And I looked at her, because there was a part of me thinking, well, why do I have to sit in the back seat? If I want to sit in the front seat, like, it was that choice was being taken away. And I was in my head having this little dialogue with myself, trying to really look at where I was truly with respect to adapting to this new culture. And I looked at the woman, my friend, and I said, how do you feel when you sit in the back seat? And she told me that she felt loved, and she felt safe, and she felt that people cared about her. And I'm sitting next to her, and I'm feeling like there's a choice being taken away from me. And I knew that her feeling was as real as my feeling, mm-hmm. and came from as real a place as mine did. But the difference was that we had two different frames of reference in trying to interpret what was going on. And it was profound for me, because that was the point of intercultural conflict that I knew I had to help people understand. That we use the same language at some time. Sometimes we even may even display the same behaviors, but there may be different meanings behind those behaviors and what we are interpreting. And the only way we're ever going to understand is if we create environments that allow us to ask those questions, which can be difficult questions.
I would have probably been miffed if I was to sit at the end of the bus, because that's how I've been socialized.
The reality is we're perceiving the world as we are. Mm-hmm. So we're perceiving the world as we've been socialized. And is that right? Is that wrong? There's cultures all over this world living as they have been. And they're on their own journey of getting to where they need to be. Part of my role then was to create environments that were safe enough that we could start having those conversations where people would ask those difficult questions.
Now, what I really liked about what you're saying, and I think this could be a takeaway for our listeners, is that you moved past the behavior and looked deeper into the meaning. And as you were talking about that, I was asking myself, how many times do I go through the day and just look at the behavior because I'm busy or distracted, and I don't take the time to really give space to the meaning?
You're making such an important point, is that we do go through the world, and we have been socialized to look at behaviors and actions and interpret them. And we interpret them from our own experience and our own assumptions and our own beliefs. And we can be really wrong sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we can know if we're right, if we ask the person, if we tell them, you know, this is how that behavior, this is how that action, this is how I'm perceiving it. This is what I believe you're saying to me. Or this is what this word means to me. Is that the message that you're trying to get across? And it's amazing sometimes that we can be really off base, especially when we're dealing with diversity of culture, people that have gone through the world in a different place.
Yeah. I liked when you said you were naive
Oh, my goodness. I thought I was so...
You were a woman of the world.
Well, I lived on an island in the middle of the Atlantic my whole life. So you can imagine the woman of the world I truly am. What I believed about myself is that I had this great capacity. I thought I could do this. I could certainly help make this difference. And I was very lucky to be introduced to Dr. Mitch Hammer, who became my mentor. Dr. Hammer was very gentle in helping me see where I truly was on that spectrum of adapting into another culture. And I was in that place of always looking for sameness, which is a beautiful place. It's not a judgment. It's a beautiful place to be because you're looking for what our interconnectedness, what makes us the same, and how we can come together and socialize together or be people together and be more accepting of each other. The true inclusion and integration is about the journey of really starting to understand the differences and being able to adapt to those differences in a way your mind is not in conflict. So it's about that flow of those differences and flow into what would be another approach.
You're talking about the sameness, but also leaving a space or creating the space for the areas that aren't the same. And it's striking that balance, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's about becoming comfortable in that because some of the differences may challenge your values. Some of the differences you may not be open to accepting. Mm-hmm. It's integration or inclusion. It's not about having to always accept. It's about honoring that a person is on another journey that's not yours. Conflict is about differences. Conflict is about having a different opinion. It's about having a different vision or a different understanding, or something has happened where two people are seeing an issue or there is a challenge that's creating this tension. And what I would say to you is that emotion, no matter what culture you are from, every culture has a range of emotions. And those emotions are anything from joy to sadness to frustration to feeling hurt to feeling overwhelmed to feeling depressed to feeling joyful, happy. But every culture has these emotions. And those differences, when you feel challenged or someone's violating something that's important to you, you will feel emotion in response to that. And that's because people care about where they come from, who they are, but also they also care about each other.
Mm.
And that's fundamental to what I've learned, is that in every situation when there's a conflict, there is a value that's been challenged or a need that's been challenged or felt to be violated or felt to be somehow disrespected, and people are feeling some form of emotion in response to that. Depending on your cultural influence, you may be very expressive in how you show that emotion, or you may not be expressive. You may not show any response. But the reality is, in your heart, you're feeling all kinds of feelings. And what I say to people and what I've learned from so many individuals who have been my teachers in this is that most of us want that issue to be addressed. Most of us do not like that feeling of being so tormented and in turmoil, because if it's not addressed, what happens is we start to see the person with the eye of that emotion. So if someone's hurt me, when I see the person, my lens of how I look at them is with that hurt. That's what guides my understanding of them. If I feel someone has broken my trust, my lens of how I see them is with that lens of distrust. And that doesn't matter what culture I'm from, because that emotion is what's guiding how I see the person then. But I'm also looking at their behavior. So if I have a perception of what that behavior means that comes from my cultural background and my experiences, then I add then upon my feeling and that lens of seeing them, all my beliefs. So I create the picture of who that person is from who I am, not from who they are. Because I haven't really provided them with the opportunity to speak to any of what I'm feeling or any of what I'm seeing. That's what conflict resolution or dispute resolution is about, is creating that space to have those conversations. And in some cultures, and what I learned very quickly in the Middle East, is to have that conversation, at times they may want someone to be that like kind of wise person that they come to and tell you how they're feeling and ask you then to go to the other individual to talk to them, because the relationship with that person is so important that they don't want to lose face with the person. And because by losing face or by challenging, that may threaten what is that communal importance of who we all are in this world. And so they will ask someone to help guide and nurture that restorative healing. That's been pretty powerful for me, to learn that we all have different ways to try to accomplish fundamentally what we all want, and that's that resolve of that pain that's in our heart or in our belly because an issue is impacting us and tormenting us.
So, Kathy, let's say I'm sitting here and I'm feeling emotional about something. I've been challenged with one of my values. What could you offer a person that would help them move forward a little bit? I know one thing that you're probably going to say is to recognize that your lens, as you so nicely put it, is being colored by that emotion.
When you think about the conflicts that we come into in our lives, oftentimes the first time I sit with them and trying to create a space that's their space to tell their story of what's happening in their life. This is their journey in their life. What I would oftentimes find is that they talk about the person or the other group or the people that they're in conflict. At some point, I'll ask them to look around the room, and they'll look around, and I say, I need right now or in this room, and they say, yes, there's you and there's me. Whose story can I really hear right now? And you know, a person will always say, well, my story. So, and then I'll ask, well, tell me the story of who you are in the middle of this. Who are you in the middle of this? I'll get them to talk about what's important to them. And oftentimes it's a value of maybe it's respect or fairness, trust, but they'll talk about how important that is to them. And then we'll do some work around understanding that as being important to them and how that individual and that action, and that's what I would say, like, explain to me again the action. Mm-hmm. Because what happens in conflict is people start to look at the person, not the action or the behavior. And it becomes really personal. Like, this person did this to me. So I'll try to help them understand, well, what was the action that really triggered this feeling? And then they'll describe the action. And we'll talk about what they thought as soon as that action, what was your first thinking? And about their own assumptions that are connected to their values and their relationship and history with that person. Mm. And then how that's impacting how they're seeing the situation. It's a coaching work that takes some time and really takes an investment on the person. Because what I do is I'll ask a lot of questions. Sydney Noble was a mentor for me in this area, and she's a wonderful woman who is a great teacher in the power of questions. So asking the questions of a person to help them gain clarity, because the answer is within them.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE on Blog Talk Radio. For information on Firefly Willows, please explore our website, fireflywillows.com, or like us on Facebook. And now, back to Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn McDonald and Kathy Murphy.
I have this wonderful woman who came to see me early in my time in Qatar. She came to tell me a story about a conflict that she was having with an employee who was Canadian and that she truly believed was being disrespectful. And in my practice, when people would become animated and screaming and shouting and they get very angry, well, you get kind of quieter because you're trying just to create balance to that behavior, like to that emotion, which I thought was what I was supposed to do. So she spoke to me for about probably 10 minutes, and then she stood up. And she looked at me and she said, "Am I boring you? I am leaving this session. Look at you, how calm you are. Look at how calm you are, and I'm telling you the worst story of my day. And you sit there so calm. You have not raised your voice." And I asked her if she would stay and help me understand what I had done. And she explained to me that her story was so important to her, she interpreted my reaction as I was not validating her at all. And not that I would validate her, but I was not hearing her. To hear her, my voice should get louder. To hear her, I should become more expressive so that she would know that I was truly understanding the level of emotion she was feeling. And she felt my response as being absolutely passive and not interested. And I have always been thankful to her for that because she was so honest with me. And I believed at that point that was a gift to me.
Now, Kathy, in order to do this work, and anybody can tell by listening to you that you're doing exactly what you're meant to do, how do you nourish yourself? What gives you strength? What do you do for Kathy?
That's a good question too, Mildred Lynn. And every time people say to me, "What do you love to do?" I love to cook. And I love to cook for a group of people. And I want to make soup.
Oh, you want to make soup?
I want to make soup. And I want to feed soup to people. And I just want to love them.
Okay.
So, and that's important. So I want their energy, and it's important to me. And I want to give back in bringing them together. So that's around cooking and nurturing and loving them. I love yoga. I sit, not always consistently. Sometimes I just sit on a chair, but try to meditate. I love to ride my bike. I'm very active. I love to feel strong. And I get a lot of joy on the water. It's a place where I'm really, really happy.
So it sounds like you know what to do to nourish yourself. And I have to ask you, what type of soup do you make?
Well, you know, anything from a seafood bouillabaisse, which is, to me, the most beautiful thing in the world.
Yeah.
A pot of soup with a lovely, rich fish stock and all kinds of fresh fish in it. And I make chicken soup all the time for people for all kinds of reasons with a whole lot of love, and I bring people soup, curry soups, Italian minestrone. I'll try anything.
Kathy, you are transitioning with the capital T, and I know that that's bringing up all kinds of interesting conversations with yourself on different levels. And I wanted to ask you, do you have any guidance for people who are going through changes in their life?
I've been reflecting a lot. I've been reflecting, and I've had a half a century. As of December 31st,
uh-huh,
I'll be 50. And I've really reflected on that 50 years. I do believe that most of that time, I truly understood why I was here. And I always had a sense of, I'm here for a purpose. I was in service, and I was very happy to be in service. It made sense to me, and it felt good to me. And I did all kinds of different things, too. I mean, I would take a year off to nurture myself. I did documentaries. I would go away and study. I was always kind of investing in who I was as well. And for the first time I can truly say I'm in this world and I'm not feeling what the next 50 years should be. And it's thrown me off. So I'm sitting at times thinking, now what am I going to do for the next 50 years as I'm leaving this province? My husband's in Ottawa. I'm moving to Ottawa in January. So the country mouse is going right into the city, right downtown Ottawa, in a big brick building. So what I've been doing with myself and what I've been saying to myself lately is I just need to start trusting and giving that over again and maybe getting a little bit more quiet with it, because I was really noisy in that I was going to start this and I was going to plan all kinds of different things. But it was just noise is what I'm learning for me. So I'm allowing myself to get a little quiet and maybe just to listen a little bit more, and hopefully the work that I'm going to be doing in Ottawa will become clearer, because I am still in service. And that's been, you know, sometimes my friends get really uncomfortable when I say these things, but I'm laughing now if any of them are listening. Because I truly believe that I'm in this world to be in service. What that's going to look like, I'm just waiting for that kind of guidance to help me understand that, because that I trust and that I believe in. I think I just panicked a little because there's so many changes. And I'm realizing now this transition is about so many changes, changing jobs, changing homes, children moving out, like having adult children, leaving my family, and, you know, that's very important. So I'm taking myself out of all the things that kept me safe.
Yes.
And I'm allowing myself to go somewhere that's very different.
Yeah, I really liked what you said about being busy, because I think many people naturally, when they're making a transition or a change, busy themselves up.
Yes.
So it's almost like they're rushing for the change and they're busy, 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 and that's what's going to fill the space. And it's
yes.
so wise to recognize that and then step back.
To sit and listen. So I really do need to go to sit more. And I've been resisting that. And I'm not sure why.
So Kathy, before we wrap up, I'm wondering if there's any nugget of wisdom that you've learned along the Happy Trail that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Fundamentally, what I've learned, and I've learned it from many people in many communities, is that there has to be kindness towards ourselves first. And the ability to see and look at yourself with love and with caring and to accept where you are without the judgment, to be really able to ask yourself honestly, like, how am I here right now? What's important to me? And to be honest with those answers, and to be able to do that in a way that maintains your fundamental self, your integrity. I oftentimes feel that the greatest thing I've ever done in my life is sit and be present for somebody's story, and to be able to hear it with kindness and with caring and with love and without judging it. And then to reflect it back the same way to that person, so they see themselves through those eyes. And if we could create the space that we can do that for ourselves, that we can see ourselves with kindness and caring and love, understanding. And then from there, if there's learning, to move through that learning, that can really provide a space for some very positive change for yourself, especially if there's something that you're needing to address or something that you feel that you need to do. And it has to start with ourselves. It has to start with what's the realest, and that's who we believe we are. I laugh at myself a lot, and, you know, at times with tears.
Yes.
Yeah. And just to allow that to happen, I think that could be a turning point for a lot of people, just giving themselves that.
Well, I'm really looking forward to having Kathy back on the show with us. And perhaps next time she'll even share some of her homemade soup recipes. Please stay tuned for What's Your Prescription for Balance, where I'll share with you the secret behind the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen. But before I do that, I'd like to thank Robert Cotter of St. John's, Newfoundland, for his great music track that we've been enjoying today. It's called Hope All River Falls. Robert composed the piece and is joined by Nathan Cotter and Andrew Reich. And now, here's this week's episode of What's Your Prescription for Balance? I know I teased you about the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, but I couldn't resist because I was so pleased that an environmental working group was doing something catchy and fun to attract people's attention. So would it surprise you to know that our little mystery relates to fruit, vegetables, and pesticides? Each year, the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit organization with a pretty generic and not very exciting name, hint, hint, offers important work in the form of a comprehensive list of fruits and veggies as they are ranked by pesticide contamination. In short, it provides guidance for those of us who prefer to eat our fruits and vegetables as clean and chemical-free and natural as possible. This year marks the 8th edition of the guide, and it ranks 45 common fruits and vegetables, which I'll share with you later on. And in case you're wondering, the fruit and vegetable samples are first washed and peeled prior to being tested, so the rankings really reflect the amount of crop chemicals that are likely to be present in the food when it's eaten by people like me or people like you. On a going to the grocery store level, most people would find this information useful to help them decide which fruits and vegetables should be bought organic. That is, unless you're very fond of pesticides and strive to ingest as many as possible each and every day. The good news is that the Clean 15 contains five or less chemicals, while the Dirty Dozen test positive for, now get ready to sit back and gasp, 47 to 67 chemicals. Which makes me wonder, what does our body do with all these different chemicals? How does it process them? Where does it put them? How do they impact our health? I think you get my drift. The other good news is that according to the Environmental Working Group, certain types of organic produce can reduce the amount of toxins that you consume on a daily basis by as much as 80%. If you're sitting there asking yourself, well, why are some types of fruits and vegetables more prone to absorbing pesticides than others? The answer lies in the defense properties of the outer layer of protective skin on the fruit or vegetables. For example, pineapples and eggplants have more protection than strawberries and grapes. Needless to say, the pineapples and eggplant are on the group of the Clean 15, and the poor old strawberries and grapes are condemned to the Dirty Dozen. If you're eager to read a list of the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15, here's the website, www.ewg.org/foodnews/summary. Better still, why not grow your own fruits and vegetables? Plus, with all those veggie and fruit peels floating around, how about composting? In fact, Lynn Fang, who I interviewed a couple of months ago, is offering a great online composting course that may just tickle your fancy. It's called The Art and Science of Urban Composting, and you'll find it at www.lynnfang.com/courses. If you have a passion for permaculture, please check out the fabulous blogs at Australia's heart-centered Varanasi Estate. Here's the website, www.varanasi.com. ESTATE.com. And better still, please, please, please visit and support your local farmers market. And now, without further ado, drum roll and lots of clapping, here's the Environmental Working Group's 2012 list of the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen. The Clean 15: onions, sweet corn, pineapples, avocado, cabbage, sweet peas, asparagus, mangoes, eggplant, kiwi, cantaloupe domestic, sweet potatoes, grapefruit, watermelon, and mushrooms. Let's go to the Dirty Dozen. Apples, celery, sweet bell peppers, peaches, strawberries, nectarines imported, grapes, spinach, lettuce, cucumbers, blueberries domestic, potatoes, plus. We have a special plus category for green beans and kale greens. And the reason they have that is because these two vegetables may contain pesticide residues of special concern. Yummy. Now, does this mean that you shouldn't eat fruits and vegetables on the Dirty Dozen list? No. The Environmental Working Group's guidance is to thoroughly wash these fruits and vegetables with the reality check that washing will not get rid of all the chemicals or pesticides. So at the end of the day, the best thing that you can do is make a good choice, to make an informed decision about the type of fruits and vegetables that you choose to put into your one and only body and the one and only bodies of your loved ones. And once again, for those of you who would like to print out a copy of the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15, the information can be found at www.ewg.org/foodnews/summary. This is Mildred Lynn McDonald. I hope that the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 added a little fodder to chew on as you go about your day. As a special treat, I'll leave you with the music of Newfoundland's Robert Cotter. Here's Hope All River Falls. Thanks for listening to Healing Conversations. And for all our Canadian listeners, Happy Canada Day. Enjoy.
To learn more about today's guests or one of the topics discussed, go to fireflywillows.com/live. And for more information about Firefly Willows LIVE upcoming shows, visit our page at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillows LIVE. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week for Revolve with High C as we travel through the sands of time back to ancient Egypt. High C will speak with Richard Reedy, author of Eternal Egypt, Ancient Rituals for the Modern World. Hear how the rituals and spiritual practices of the ancient Egyptians continue to resonate in our world and lives today, and how we can connect with the gods and goddesses of Egypt in our modern spiritual practices. We'll also explore ancient Egyptian magic. Be sure to call in for live on-air readings during the latter part of the show to hear which of the Egyptian gods wants to speak to you and what messages and guidance they hold for your life. All this and more on the next episode of Revolve with High C. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE Blog Talk Radio.